What is up, you lily-livered, action-taking horse and glass-gazing, super-serviceable, finical rogues? Welcome to No Holds Barred, the Shakespeare podcast Shakespeare would have listened to. I'm Dan Bollier.
And I'm Kevin Condardo. This week we are back with our monthly So You're Going to See episodes. The idea of these episodes is that it's something that you can listen to in transit to a Shakespearean production, so that we can prepare you to be the best little audience member that you can be.
An audio version of the dramaturgical notes, if you will.
So, hopefully, you'll enjoy this episode as you head out to see King Lear.
Here we go.
The first thing we need to cover before we get into this episode is a quick synopsis of the play, so you at least know the story going in. Dan, take it away.
Great. So we start with King Lear, who has called the court together to essentially announce his retirement and divide his kingdom between his three daughters based on how much they each love him. His eldest daughter, Goneril, says she loves him more than anything else in the world. His middle daughter, Regan, or Reagan, based on your production you see, says basically the same. His youngest and favorite daughter, Cordelia, however, declines to play her father's game and says she loves him as a daughter should, no more, no less. Lear doesn't take too kindly to this and responds by offering Cordelia to wed the King of France with no dowry, effectively banishes her, and splits his kingdom down the middle between Goneril and Regan, and announces from then on he will alternate living at the castles of his two older daughters.
Meanwhile, Edmund, who is the illegitimate son of the Duke of Gloucester, frames his brother, the legitimate Edmund, for planning to murder their father, the Duke, by forging a letter. When his father comes around, he's like, hey, what's that letter? Edmund's like, oh, I can't show you this letter. And finally, he's like, all right, fine, you can read the letter, which says that Edgar is planning to murder Gloucester. Gloucester demands Edmund resolve the situation with his brother, and Edmund goes to find his brother Edgar and says, hey, you better stay far away because Dad wants you dead. He then celebrates at how good he is at manipulating his family.
Goneril has already gotten tired of putting up with Lear, as if he were a king when he is now basically nothing more than a boarder, and she and Regan conspire to strip him of basically his entire entourage, except for his fool and his most loyal knight, Kent, who is disguised as Caius.
Edmund, now hearing rumors that Goneril and Regan's husbands, Cornwall and Albany, may be taking up arms against each other, finds his brother and tells him that word on the street is that it's Edgar's fault for kicking this whole thing off because people are saying he's talking a lot of smack. They basically stage a fight that Gloucester catches the end of and Edgar runs away. Edmund says that Edgar attacked him because he was defending his father, Gloucester. Gloucester, who is outraged, says he will demand that Edgar be put to death.
Right. So Edgar, who is now on the run and with a bounty on his head, does the only logical thing that anyone would do in terms of self-preservation. He strips himself stark naked, covers himself in mud, and acts like a filthy mad beggar, referring to himself only as poor Tom.
As we all would.
Of course.
Lear, now outraged that his daughters have refused his demands to be treated like a king, even though he's not a king anymore, stumbles out onto a heath during a storm and rages as Kent and the fool beg him to get out of the elements. At long last, and possibly in a moment of compassion for the fool, seeing how wet and disgusting and miserable he is, Lear agrees to go into a nearby hovel to get out of the rain, but when they approach that hovel, they find poor Tom, who, for those of you scoring at home, is the disguised Edgar, living there. Upon seeing this naked beggar, Lear is totally into it and decides to rip his clothes off as well. Before he can do that, Gloucester shows up and begs Lear to come inside someplace to get out of the storm. Lear says he will come, but only if poor Tom comes with him. Gloucester doesn't recognize his son in disguise and says, yeah, fine, whatever, let's go. And they go.
Meanwhile, word is spreading that the French army, led by the Queen of France, Cordelia, has arrived on a nearby shore. Regan and her husband Cornwall summon Gloucester and interrogate him regarding the location of Lear, which he refuses to give up. In response, they kick out his f***ing eyeballs and throw him out into the elements.
Edgar comes across his blinded father, who is so miserable that he's literally begging strangers to lead him to a cliff so he can jump off and kill himself. In the guise of poor Tom, Edgar leads him to a field and says, hey, yeah, you're definitely on the edge of a cliff. When Gloucester steps forward and falls like a foot, Edgar switches characters and takes on the role of a local fisherman and says, oh my God, dude, you totally just fell like a million feet. How are you not dead? That's wicked bananas.
Nice.
And at that moment, Lear, madly dressed and wearing a crown of flowers and totally out to lunch, enters and, despite his madness, recognizes the blinded Gloucester. Shortly after this, the French army, led by Cordelia, finds him and brings him in to take care of him.
Meanwhile, Regan's husband, Cornwall, has died from a wound sustained when he blinded Gloucester, and Goneril has become disgusted with her husband, Albany, for his disgust in the way that they've treated Lear. Fortunately, the two sisters are now both madly in love with and competing for the affection of Edmund.
Is that what we call it?
Yeah, sure. The affection of Edmund. Because what could possibly go wrong with that?
So Edmund, who is now the commander of both Regan and Goneril's united forces, defeats the French and captures Lear and Cordelia because we can't have nice things. When Albany asks Edmund to bring out the prisoners, Lear and Cordelia, Edmund tells him to go F himself. Albany accuses him of treason as he is not part of the royal family, but Regan says he will be shortly as she intends to marry him. Goneril, outraged, poisons her, and Regan dies. Edgar then shows up in disguise and challenges Edmund to a duel. Edgar kills him and reveals his true identity. Goneril, in response, runs out of the room and stabs herself to death. With Edmund now dead, Albany sends for the captive Lear and Cordelia. Bad news, Cordelia has already been hung, and Lear, totally mad, enters carrying her body. When he realizes she's dead, his heart literally breaks and he dies. Albany asks Kent and Edgar to assume rule of the kingdom, but Kent is like, nah, actually, if my lord is dead, I need to go the same way. And he wanders off, apparently to die too, leaving Albany and Edgar there. And that is King Lear. Now that you know what you'll be watching, we're going to take a few minutes to talk about where King Lear falls in Shakespeare's personal timeline and what was happening in the world when it was written, Dan.
Yes. So this play was probably written in 1605, late 1605, but it debuted at Whitehall on December 26th, 1606, which is, as you may recognize, the year of Lear, as coined by Jim Shapiro.
Friend of the podcast.
Friend of the, of course, major friend of the podcast. And so this was coming out in the same year. In terms of what else was happening that year for Shakespeare specifically, he had two other shows that opened, which you probably haven't heard of, Antony and Cleopatra and Macbeth.
Mm-hmm.
So down year for Shakespeare.
Decent year for royalties. There are rumors at this time that there have been some discussion that this that Lear might be loosely based on James the First, but it's actually almost definitely the opposite of that, as James the First was on record at this point as advising his son to give everything to his eldest son, James's grandson, and not dividing up the kingdom as he had apparently discussed or considered doing. James the First basically said, don't split things up. That's a recipe for disaster.
Right.
Curiously, though, this play appears to have only been produced or played under five times, as opposed to all of the other plays which we know had extended runs. There are only evidence of one or two performances of this play in Shakespeare's lifetime, which is a little bit of a question mark.
Right. It's really interesting, and that's actually great that you brought that up, Kev, because something, I mean, if you want to know about the year, there's literally a book about it. It's amazing. Check it out. So in prepping for this segment, I looked at specifically the day, December 26th, which holds significance for a couple of reasons. It's St. Stephen's Day, and it's also Boxing Day. So St. Stephen's, I don't know what either of those things were part of this. So I looked it up. St. Stephen's Day St. Stephen was the first Christian martyr, someone who died for a cause. His name comes from the Greek word Stephanos, which translates to crown, which is interesting. And in all of the pictures of St. Stephen, he is depicted with three stones around him. So this idea of like a trilogy or the number three and the idea of splitting the kingdom into three parts is really interesting in terms of St. Stephen, this play debuting for the king at his palace on St. Stephen's Day. And one thing we do know about King James is that he was a major numerologist.
Mm-hmm.
And the number three holds significant. So, I mean, if you look at the three witches in Macbeth, which came out this year, and also you have the idea of division of, into three kingdoms, the number three is big for James.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing for December 26th is Boxing Day is a day to celebrate the servants, because typically the servants would work on Christmas. So the next day, they it's like the Bob Cratchit holiday.
Sure, sure.
Where they get the next day off. So that whole idea of like the servants rising to power is really interesting when you think about people like Kent in this play.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is kind of cool.
In terms of what was going on in like the TMZ element of the world at this time, there are two very interesting gossip stories that probably played right into this. A year or two earlier, the eldest daughter of Brian Ansley, who was an aging wealthy gentleman pensioner, tried to have her father declared a lunatic so she and her husband could take over his affairs, get all of his money, get all of his land. The oldest daughter and the middle daughter were kind of angling for this, but her older man's youngest daughter, Cordell, C-O-R-D-E-L-L, appealed successfully to the local duke, to not have him declared a lunatic. And when he died, she got the full windfall.
Wow.
So that would have been in the headlines. And the other headline is that Robert Dudley, the Earl of Leicester, who was one of Queen Elizabeth's favorite, had an illegitimate son that he totally denied being his because he didn't want Queen Elizabeth to get mad at him. And in his will, he referred to this bastard child as bastard or base literally 17 times in his will.
Wow.
So bastard and base being repeated over and over and over again in Edmund's monologue is probably a topical, timely reference.
That Shakespeare.
Right? That guy. So there you go. That is a little bit of what was going on at the time. This is where we identify what we consider to be the most prominent theme in the play and some particular places where you may see it come up. Dan has chosen his three favorite options, and I'm going to pick my choice of those three for us to dig in on. So Dan, what are our finalists for Miss Best Theme?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that, Kevin. I had an answer prepared.
I'm good, good.
That's how this works. So for King Lear, the three themes that most interest me for the sake of this podcast are vision, nothing, and forgiveness.
Okay, I'm going to go with vision, and I'll tell you exactly why. We joke a lot about this. We tell the truth a lot about on this podcast about how we both got fives on our AP English exams.
Yes.
And the essay I wrote on my AP English exam to get that five was on vision in King Lear. That's
a true
story.
I should have known that and not even put it on the list.
So here comes a five answer on vision. You know, that's an easy, I like this because one of the best lines, one of the best echoes in this play is "See better, Lear."
Yes.
That's Kent, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So just telling, you know, that obviously there's the direct hit over the head with a hammer version where Gloucester gets his f***ing eyeballs kicked out.
Right.
But people in this play are constantly not seeing what is so obviously in front of them.
Right.
You have in that first scene, Goneril and Regan just saying what Lear wants to hear, Cordelia being honest and Lear doesn't see that. You have Gloucester begging Lear to come in and Lear saying Tom has to come with him and Gloucester not seeing that it's his son. You have Gloucester not seeing the ruse that that Edmund is pulling over on him, despite the fact that it makes no sense based on Edgar's track record.
Right, right, right.
So there are so many instances in this play of people not seeing what is so plainly in front of them, both metaphorically and literally.
Right. To piggyback on the idea of once you get past Gloucester having his eyes knocked out, he has a great line where Lear asks him, you know, can you... You can, without eyes, you can see the world. And he's like, I see it feelingly, which is one of those great, like, oh, goosebumpy, like, right, now that I'm not wrapped up in the day-to-day, like, things around me that I'm looking at, now I can actually see what's going on. Mm-hmm. And that sense of, it's the paradox, which I think almost always you can come back to with Shakespeare, the idea of only when you're blind can you truly see, which is, I think, part of what Shakespeare is warning us against or telling us in the play. And the response, Kent's response to see better, when he says see better, the line right before it is Lear says, out of my sight.
Mm.
So you have the image of see, the words see and sight are in this play so many times.
Mm-hmm.
It just keeps coming up in terms of, yes, actually literally seeing eye to eye or emotionally seeing. That idea of just awareness is really... Mm-hmm.
Awareness, yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, it goes up and down the line because, you know, how many people in this play are disguised?
Right.
Kent is. Yep. Edgar is. Edmund is he at some point?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question. I was talking to a friend of the podcast, Ryan Higgins, about disguises with Edmund. Because if you look at the folio, it's in the first scene... It's EDM period for all of his lines, for Edmund's lines. And then in his next scene, when he concocts the ruse to put on Gloucester that Edgar is trying to kill him, in the middle of that scene, the name changes to Bast, B-A-S-T, period. And then for the rest of the play in the folio, it's Bastard. So we were talking about the idea is the role of Bastard, is that a disguise? That, you know, that Edgar puts on poor Tom and Edmund puts on, okay, you all see me as the Bastard. I can play that.
Right.
I will play the Bastard.
Yeah.
So that's his disguise.
What's Shylock's line or I will, that about how you make, I play what you think I am or something. I don't remember.
He has one, and so does Don John in Much Ado.
Mm.
So there's the recurring theme of the villains being like, okay, you cast me as the villain, I will do it.
I will do it.
If that's how you see me, I will be that.
So
that
there you go,
back
folks.
To Vision.
Vision, folks. Keep an eye out for it when you go out to see King Lear. In this section of the show, we choose which non-title characters we would most want to play in this piece and explain why in 2 minutes or less. Dan won the coin flip before the show and has elected to go first. So, Dan, take it away.
Sure. So, since King Lear is off the board and I can't play King Lear, which I really should for the sake of all of you.
Really?
Yep. I think I've been wrestling with this. I think for the sake of interest in the pod, I'm going to go with Kent.
Okay.
I think Kent is an amazing role. I mean, Edgar was right there. Edgar is a dream role, but we've talked about that many, many, many times. So if you want to know about why I think that, go back and binge previous episodes.
Listen to every episode or at least download them.
So for a new idea, Kent. I think he's got tremendous range. He's a grinder. He's someone that in the play, when you really look at it, and if you're looking at it from a literary standpoint, it makes sense. But from an acting standpoint... He's tremendously challenging. In terms of the whole bit with Oswald, where inexplicably this guy who is super good, Kent is just like a really solid, good guy, just beats the crap out of this guy for really no apparent reason, which raises some major concerns for me as an actor to go like, how do I create a character that's consistent and has this one moment? So I think that might be like, a week of the rehearsal process and many sleepless nights before the first rehearsal of going, how the hell am I going to do this? I also just like when he's in the stocks and he's like, yeah, I'm fine here. I'm good.
You
can put me in. Like, he's just got so many responses. I really like the way that Kent responds to many, many challenges in the play.
Mm-hmm.
So major underrated character in a play full of complete badasses. Kent is
all right.
My choice.
I'm going to take 10 seconds since you finished early. I think to solve that problem about how he treats Oswald is actually the responsibility of Oswald and not Kent.
That's fair.
I think Oswald needs to generate heat, to use a professional wrestling term, so that it just Kent can't get there himself. It's Oswald who has to make that work.
Works for me.
But I digress. For my recommended role, actually, like Dan, and to the surprise of no one, the role I would want to play in this is Edmund, the bastard. So Dan and I are available to play Edgar and Edmund to literally anyone.
For a nominal fee.
Listening for a more than nominal fee. But to make things more interesting, since you can hear that again by downloading and whatever, if you want to listen to every other episode, go to. I'm going to go with Regan.
Cool.
As my recommended role. And this is something that actually came out in a production I saw at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. I forget who. It was the Frank Langella Lear, but the Regan they had in that production was so amazing. And usually you see Goneril and Regan as like the Cinderella wicked stepsisters, and they're kind of like, they're not exactly the same. They're not cookie cutters of each other, but it's tough to differentiate those two roles. And just the way that Regan, and I should probably pull up her name since I'm fluffing her like this.
Don't worry, I'm on it while you're okay. Talking.
She just had like the arc that she took in both the Glee in that scene where Gloucester is getting her eyeballs kicked out. Because Cornwall is just a monster for doing that. But it was clear that Regan was working the reins, you know?
Sure.
She had control of that scene in a way that usually it's Cornwall flying off the handle, but she controlled it as if he was her monster. And then when he died, she was like, it didn't really bother her. And she just went on to the next and found Edmund. And she didn't find Goneril to be a threat. And then when she was poisoned, it was like a total shock to her that she never saw coming. It was almost like a Lady Mac type of thing that
right.
She had it all figured out. And then she dies, and it was wonderful. So that would be a lot of fun. Did you find her name?
Yeah, it's Lauren O'Neill, friend of the podcast.
She was fantastic. So there we go. I would say there is a lot to mine in the arc for Regan. This is the section of the show where we pull our favorite phrase from this play and talk through it so that you can nod smugly and knowingly when you hear it. The line we chose from King Lear is never, 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 never from Act 5, Scene 3. Let's hear the phrase in context.
All friends shall taste the wages of their virtue, and all foes the cup of their deservings. Oh, see!
And my poor fool is hanged. No, no, no life. Why should a dog, a horse, a rat have life, and thou no breath at all? Thou'lt come no more. Never. 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 Never! You undo this button. Thank you, sir. Do you see this? Look on her. Look. Her lips. Look there. Look there.
He faints. My lord. My lord.
Break, heart. I prithee break.
Look up, my lord.
Vex not his ghost. Oh, let him pass. He hates him much that would upon the rack of this tough world stretch him out longer. That was Never 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 from Act 5, Scene 3 of King Lear. Dan, can you give us a little context on this?
Sure. This is the part where Lear dies.
Cool. Yeah, we are literally 15 lines from the end of the play at this point, so all spoiler alerts are up.
A little more context for you is, Albany is basically laying out what's going on with basically everyone who has been close to Goneril and Regan and Edmund. They are going to get their comeuppance, and the people who have done their best to help Lear and the good folk will get what they deserve too. And it's peace is coming. Everything, this is like, it's a false happy ending, basically. I'm like, all friends shall taste the wages of their virtue, and all the foes the cups of their deservings. Oh, crap. Oh, God, look, Lear. Look, check out what Lear's doing.
Right.
And then there's this great line, my poor fool is hanged, which is basically the fodder for the entire Cordelia fool conspiracy theory.
Right.
And then you get this recognizable dog, a horse, a rat, which you might recognize from Romeo and Juliet or from Marlowe, talking about in the moment of death, rambling about these animals. And then this incredible line, never, 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 followed by, please undo my button. Oh, look at, oh no, she's breathing. And then he dies.
And he dies with that thought that she may be still alive. This also, usually when this scene is, I mean, kind of universally, this scene happens with, it has to happen with Lear entering, carrying Cordelia, which is one of the challenges. You know, obviously we kind of haven't touched on this at all, but Lear is kind of the a bookend role for a lot of actors. You know, you're 70, you do 70, I mean, you should be over 80 to play Lear, but you're at the end, you know, you're, this is your last hurrah, and the challenge is always, and I think they joke about this in Slings and Arrows in the Lear season,
yeah,
that in the first rehearsal, the guy playing Lear comes in and looks at Cordelia and is like, oh, I hope I can carry you. I'll have to figure that out. But that is that is a real problem for, you know, you have to find a Lear that can carry on a Cordelia at the end here.
Right, right. Yeah, it's tough. It's a real tough line.
Yeah. And so the reason that I think the never, 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 never jumps out for me is because anytime, you know, as a general rule, anytime Shakespeare is repeating a word, there are other times where he'll repeat a word twice.
Yeah.
And he's not just doing that because he's like, I need another syllable here. I only have 8 beats. Here's another one.
Right.
There's always a reason that he's repeating a word. And usually, you know, as an actor, when you find the word repeated twice, you don't just say it twice the same way. You have to figure out, well, why did he say it twice here? So here Shakespeare gives it to you 5 times. Why is Lear repeating this 5 times? What is the journey he's going on in this at the climax of this play?
Right.
That all he can say is never 5 times in reference to when Cordelia will come again. And this should absolutely leave you sobbing. No pressure Lears.
No pressure Lears out there. For the poetry lovers out there, this is a real fascinating moment. If you look at the scansion, we talk a lot about the idea of iambic pentameter, which Shakespeare traditionally writes in da-dum, 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 da-dum. The reason why that's so popular is because it is reflective of the human heartbeat. So in this moment, we're actually in trochaic pentameter, the inverse, never, 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 bum-bum, 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 which is incredibly rare in poetry. Typically, if you're in trochees, you're going to be in trochaic tetrameter, so you're having 8 syllable lines. So the idea of a 10 syllable line all in trochees, it's poetically a heart attack. It is the heart inverting, and then his next line, pray you undo this button. I mean, that's clinical.
Mm-hmm.
His heart is breaking. And then Kent's line, break heart, I prithee break. That to me, like, if you're not sobbing on the nevers, if you're like holding it together, like I do when I watch any sort of sports video, or I try to do, it's the break heart, I prithee break, where I'm like,
right, because he's done. Yeah.
It's so beautiful that his friend is right there being like, oh God, go.
For your own sake,
get out of here.
Absolutely. So there you go. Never, 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 never from Act 5, Scene 3 of King Lear. Keep an ear out for it when you go to see this production. Here, we will highlight the biggest practical challenge to the director of this play and share a few ideas on how it has been solved in the past. For King Lear, I think the biggest challenge is actually the line, upon these eyes of thine, I'll set my foot, from Act 3, Scene 7. Dan, you want to give us a little context on what's happening in that scene?
Right, this is the aforementioned moment of eyeballs getting kicked the f*** out of someone's dome piece.
So, not a lot of subtlety in that.
Right. So I guess the challenge might not be the line, but the action of removing someone's eyeballs on stage in front of others.
Generally troubling. Generally problematic.
Generally very difficult. But yeah, basically it's a moment where Cornwall has had enough and takes Gloucester's eyes out. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the challenge that faces every director of how are you going to do that? Like you can't cut it. It's one of those things that you can't like possibly like, well, we'll fudge it.
Yeah, no.
It is integral to the plot. Mm-hmm. So you have to just face it. Something we actually haven't talked about on this episode yet, but at the time of recording, I'm currently preparing to direct this play.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone I've talked to, nearly everyone, is like, oh, you're doing Lear? How are you going to do the eyes?
Ah.
Like it's the first thing that they ask.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, it's that in itself is a challenge that you're like, why are you doing that play? Or why do you like that play? It's, oh, tell me about the eyes.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
So you already come into it. It's like an actor playing Hamlet where it's like, ooh,
how are you going
to
do,
how are you gonna do it to be or not to be?
Sure, yeah. Like this. Right. So Dan, how have you seen this done in the past?
Sure. I've actually only ever seen Lear once. Which is pretty amazing considering the flurry of Lear's a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw this in 2003, 2004.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that I saw them do it was they had Gloucester like roped to a chair for the entire scene. And then in the moment of kicking his eyes out, they dropped the chair. It was a proscenium. And they basically dropped the chair straight back.
Mm-hmm.
So all you saw were his legs.
Yep, that's how they did it at Shakespeare in the Park a couple of summers ago.
Yeah, where, the easy way.
Yeah, so you just, and then, because the challenge here is really, upon these eyes of thine, I'll set my foot, because it was just, you rip his eyeball out. Like, the fact that he kicks his eyeballs out is, like, savage. And I don't know how you do that. So I've seen Gloucester put on his back. I think he almost always... he's always put on his back, usually bound to the chair. I do feel like I've seen one, and I can't remember which one it was, where Cornwall, they didn't put the chair down, and he just kind of like haluva kicked him in the face type of thing. Like went up and like the just from a standing position, looking straight up stage, like put the heel of his boot on the actor's cheek and kind of did like a graphic like... scrape across.
Oh wow.
And then immediately went in with hands. So it's like the initial damage was the heel, and then Cornwall went in and scooped the rest of it out. And I believe that is the production, it may have been the public production with Sam Waterston, where Cornwall then went in with his hands to the face and then like flung what was effectively so gross. It was like you know when you clean out a pumpkin, like the guts of a pumpkin, and it's all like stringy and gross.
Sure,
it was something like that, and he just like flung it upstage, and it stuck to the wall, and it was red, and that the remnant of his eyes, and it was it was rough. It was rough to watch, just like a smashed eyeball flying across.
Yeah, it can be really, it's pretty aggressive. There's a great scene in Slings and Arrows where Jeffrey Tennant is, they're doing like the production meeting.
Mm.
And he's just like has his head in his hands because people are like, check out this effect we can do.
Yeah, right.
Check out this effect. And it's like, yep, that's, if you're doing Lear, that's your life as a director.
Right. And it's like, I feel like in a weird way, you can do a lot of artful versions of Lavinia getting her tongue and hands cut off.
Yeah.
But you very rarely see that with this.
If you have time, come see the one that we're doing, because I promise you it will be artistic and it will not be flinging pumpkin seeds.
Well, as the person overseeing the props and costume restoration budget, I certainly appreciate it. So there you go, folks. Keep an eye out for how Gloucester gets his f***ing eyeballs kicked out when you go to see King Lear. All right, that is going to do it for us for this episode. If you found this helpful, please subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes so we can keep bringing Shakespeare to your headphones on a weekly basis. If you have any questions or comments you'd like to send our way, you can email us at noholdsbarredpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet us at noholdsbarredcast, or you can Facebook us at facebook.com/noholdsbarredcast. So, until next time, I'm Kevin Condardo.
And I'm Dan Bolliere.
The oldest hath borne most. We that are young
shall never see so much, nor live so long.